There's a river flowing in my soul.
We often talk about the conditions for learning as though they are things we build only inside schools. Strong relationships, safe classrooms, good curricula, high expectations. All of those matter, but Megan Bang invites us to widen the frame. Megan is a learning scientist, an Indigenous scholar, a member of the Anishinaabe people. Her work asks us to reconsider what it means for young people to thrive and to recognize that thriving is never just an individual achievement. Young people grow in relation. They grow in relation to family, community, culture, language, land, water, ancestors, and future generations. They grow also in relation to the more than human world, the living world that sustains us. Whether schools make that relationship visible or not. That at first may sound expansive, but Megan's ideas are both deeply important and practical. If we treat well-being as something located only inside a child, then our interventions become too narrow. We try to fix individuals when we should be also strengthening relationships, communities, places, systems. We ask children to regulate themselves, but we may not ask whether the environments around them are organized to support their thriving. In the first part of our conversation, Megan helps us understand relational thriving, what it means to see young people as already embedded in networks of care, responsibility, place, and history. She draws on Indigenous scholarship and learning science to show why land, water, community, and intergenerational responsibility are not just background issues. They're parts of the conditions of human development. In the second part, Megan moves directly into practice. She shows how culture shapes what counts as knowledge, evidence, science, and responsibility. She talks about story work, outdoor learning, and place-based inquiry, not as enrichment, but as rigorous learning. And she reminds us that honoring Indigenous knowledge begins with respect for Indigenous sovereignty, self-determination, present-day Indigenous peoples, and the specific histories of the land where we teach and learn. For practitioners, Megan's work invites a set of immediate questions. Where are students learning? Whose knowledge is being treated as knowledge? What stories about the past and future are young people being given? How often do they learn from the living world around them? And how might schools help young people understand not only who they are, but what and to whom they are responsible? Let's begin. First, this episode, we are exploring the conditions that allow young people to learn and thrive. One thing that runs through your work, Megan, is that those conditions are relational, not only relationships among students and adults, but relationships with land, culture, community, ancestors, and future generations. How do you think about the relational conditions that make learning and thriving possible?
I think a lot about Vine Deloria's work as a grounding for me in this, and my own teachings as an Anishinaabe person. But I think about the relational thriving as part of a relational field or a relational network, and that everyone is born into that. It's already existing, and that part of the work of creating thriving is to think about how do we continually strengthen that relational field. And for me, one of the major things that I have pressed on, like other scholars before me, but I think that I've brought it into different places in the field, is to understand that a relational field and a relational network is not just about relationships between humans. It's relationships between humans, more than humans or other than humans, and the places that we're in. And in order to thrive, that network both has to be, but it also has to, I've actually stepped back from that and just said, we have to recognize it. And I start with Vine Deloria's work because part of what he argued is that it's not just our perception of our relational field, it's actually the sort of ontological recognition of it. Human beings don't exist without our relationships to the natural world. And so for me, the conditions for thriving actually is connected to his idea of maturation. And really, he thought about maturation as our ability to reflect on the ordinary things of life and recognizing their meaning and their need to be in good care, in ethical care. So there's really maturity for him, or maturation for him is both the recognition of those things, but our perpetual responsibility to act in good relations. And so for me, the conditions for relational thriving is actually our ever increasing awareness of our interconnectedness. And I think concretely what that means is that we often try to figure out what the key relationships are that will enable thriving. And while I think there are really important ones, I think it really is about understanding those interconnections between humans and the more than human world. And I would argue, actually, an intergenerational connection. I think one of the things that has happened is we've reduced our views to not recognize that actually our ancestors' conditions shape our current conditions, and our conditions will shape our future generations. So I think that interconnectedness and that interconnectedness across generational time is pretty key to understanding thriving.
I think that is very clear, and your description of maturation is also very important and clear. But would you elaborate a little further? Because I really do think that a piece of groundedness, a piece of what you're talking about, is what people do, and maybe what, I should say, maybe, and what environments do that afford young people and developing people the opportunity to embody that type of maturation.
When we talk about this, it can feel abstract. But what's interesting to me is in the field of education, or perhaps the fields that make up human learning and development, this is not actually a philosophical thing. It's quite literally our human microbiome, and the health of our human microbiome is connected to the health of the place that we live. It's at the cellular level that this is true. It's not just a conceptual level. And I guess that's partly what I'm getting at, is that this is materially true for the human condition. If we don't have clean water, we can't thrive. If we don't have healthy soil, our microbiome is actually declining. I do mean that in its very material sense. And a lot of what I've tried to do is make people aware of that. But I'll say this, that what we've seen over the last 50 to 70 years is what actually it's called the devolution of human mind in relationship to our knowledge of the natural world. And so I focus a little bit there around what do we know about the more than human world? How do we even notice it? How do we reason about it? And the extent that our relationships and our knowledges about that are thriving impacts our capacities as human beings to make sustainable choices, to set up good relations, to set up societies that can thrive. So for me, this piece about relational thriving is really understanding the field of relations at a much broader scale. And there's lots of scholarship that has talked about different aspects of this, but I would argue that we have largely been human-centered for a good long while and left this other piece to other fields. And we can see that actually children who have a broader awareness of their relational fields, particularly with a more than human world, they reason differently. They make decisions differently. And I think that one of the things that I would say about this that I think is hard for societies that have been constructed to really cultivate individualisms is that children who actually have awareness about their intergenerational connection and their connection to the natural world, it actually becomes a deep source of strength, right? That being in relations, there is a way actually to see thriving, that they feel better being aware of that. So I don't know if that's what you're getting at, David, but
Okay.
that's, yeah.
It is part is the, and I just want the audience, some of who spend time reading and understanding and learning your work, others whom I hope will, to
Yeah.
really appreciate both the wonderful depth of the thought here, but in addition, how material and practical it is. And I think you're very right. And
Yeah.
to speak for a second, personally, Even though I thought I had gotten those issues, for I've been afforded the opportunity for many years to learn from people like Terry Cross and other people. But I kept on thinking about the physical environment and its thriving as being a separate domain from others. And then, ironically, not because of COVID, but just at the time that COVID was hitting, I spent a week in the desert with many other people in India, but most of the people coming from the global south were much more connected to the environments in ways you were talking about this. And I actually had a paradigm shift, an epiphany. And I said, wait a second, these things, you're getting this wrong, Osher. These are all connected. And then lo and behold, as if I needed a lesson, COVID hit. And it is such an indelible lesson, even though for the reasons that you've talked about in terms of the power of Western ontologies and things like that, people are forgetting that again, or
They
they
are.
didn't fully face it. But I think these are powerful points, and powerful points for everybody, and accessible ones. So thank you. So moving on to the next question, as I just actually said, over the past few years, I've been thinking about the importance of people being grounded in rich connections to the past, present, and future. I just hadn't thought about the environment, if you want, in a certain sense. Again, I've learned so much from you, but I also want to pull up the conversation that we've had with Kim Schoenert-Reichel, where Kim talks about well-being as not being something located only inside the child, but something shaped by relationships and by environments. And so I want to invite you, because your work extends those ideas even further. What do we miss when we treat well-being as an individual trait rather than something rooted in relationships, place, and collective life?
Actually, I think it makes it harder to get to well-being because it narrows our imagination and our perception of the many pathways that actually influence it. So, to me, part of what realization has done is it's actually misperceived this relational field that I'm talking about, but it's narrowed our capacities to actually cultivate thriving because it doesn't understand the potential ways in which our thriving has been challenged in the first place, right? And it's interesting, actually. Sometimes I think that it's just that people learn to truncate things, but we hear these stories even from far away. But let's just take Benton Harbor and the problems of water in particular places. Very quickly, we can get these stories of kind of extreme cases where you can think about uranium poisoning in the Navajo Nation, and to recognize there are these moments where land and water makes itself so visible in our lives that we think, okay, but we go back to your point about COVID, to thinking about creating an infrastructure that mutes its reality. And for me, that's true with all aspects of well-being, even our relationships with other humans. When we think it's something that an individual can control, we place the onus of that on the individual in ways that actually is never accurate and can increase the demand on a child in particular. When really, if we can think about all of the networks, then we can do more and actually we can reach more children. I think that's the other thing is we've set up systems that molecularize it to the individual, and then our systems are inefficient and we wonder why. I say often to times people is that we're now at a population level challenge about well-being for children and adolescents that demands actually we see it from a systems level, not an individual level. And I think that when we think that way, we have the possibility of intervention and shift that can reach more and more people. In my own work, I've thought about this in a really, and I think we're going to get to this, but I'll just say that if we think it's at the individual level, we think about interventions that have to reach individuals in particular delivery mechanisms, rather than thinking about what is the system that cultivates well-being in sustainable ways, cultivates thriving in sustainable ways. So I think that is one of the most dangerous things, is that it sets us up to think that individuals should or could achieve it on their own, and our pathways for supporting it then become narrowed and constricted. And I think the other thing that I would say about this is it is another construction that forgets that people are always coming into a relational field. It's never starting from nowhere. And if we don't think about that, then we place people into a situation. And then when it doesn't go well, then we're trying to recover it, rather than an ongoing relational field that we're bringing people into, supporting them in, and that continual kind of relational field. In some ways, we know these things, but it's almost like we've forgotten their profoundness about them. I think about programs that welcome freshmen into high school. It's not that we don't know this in some ways, but it's almost like we've made it trite, right? Yes. Or momentary. And so sometimes I think it's just that we need to remember the things that we have known and forgotten. And this thing, David, that you said, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about memory and forgetting lately, and the mechanisms of forgetting rather than the what would be the technologies or mechanisms of remembering. And I do think this, on some level, it's, we all know this, a thriving family helps children thrive, right? But it's almost like we've forgotten or lost faith in creating the conditions for familial thriving or communal thriving. So we've gone to this individual child model or individual person model. And it's not going to work.
And I think it doesn't work. And one of the reasons why I think your and other people's work, many of them being Indigenous scholars who are raising these issues, are not just important for the thriving of Indigenous people, but for everybody.
Absolutely.
It does not work for anybody.
Nope, that's right.
It is. And it really is undoing what may have been hidden, but has never been unpresent in their lives.
Exactly. It's why I think about it as unmutings. It's always there. It's just a question of recognition and then holding it with in what I would call the care and dignity it should be afforded. And I think there's, Ann Waters is an Indigenous scholar that would say that the core of Indigenous knowledge system, and I think Vine thinks about maturation or thought about maturation in a similar way, is that at the core of Indigenous knowledge systems, at the risk of making them all one, it is a fundamental belief in recognizing other beings and life with the care and the dignity and respect that it should be afforded. And in that, you do that for yourself too. And so there is this real recognition of the relationship between entities as at the core of Indigenous knowledge systems. And I think it's one of the things about radical individualisms that creates the problem. And then there has to be this restoration of relation as the solving that is really, I would argue, fundamentally what has been happening for a long time. And that the West and the desire for profound individualism is relearning right now, because it was always a construct. Right? There's no human being life. There's no human life without the earth. There's just not. Even through our technology. I had a little kid say to me recently, did you know that iPhones are made from the earth? And I said, I did, actually.
Yes.
But right, we humans make artifacts that forget where they came from. And it supports actually human forgetting about fundamental relationships that make life and living possible.
I want to use a word to call out something that I've been trying to resurrect. It's a Spanish word. It's still a Spanish word, but in English, it was an archaic word, which is profoundizing. And I think your thinking and what you're talking about is really profoundizing. And I mean it not to stroke you, but really it's important to hold with dignity, but hold with visibility and with salient clarity these things that are muted to the point that they become less important and therefore less impactful. When if we really have the imagination you're talking about and the awareness, we are better able to act together to do something that would support people together.
Yeah, part of what, so I'll put my cognitive science hat on a little bit about this. We can talk about it in different ways, but if you actually understand the history of shift of, I call it corporeal arrangements, but of human practice over generations, there's lots of not so profound data about this, right? Human people's time outdoors has dramatically declined over the last 3 to 5 generations. Our daily rhythms and patterns of life have dramatically changed. And we can talk about that as we got into industrial society. But if you understand that from the day, like the daily life of people, it's actually fairly significant. People spend less and less time. We used to have transportation systems where people were outside and exposed to the natural world. Now we look at it through a window. Something happens as soon as you enclose a person in something. Our attention span changes, our neural patterns change, all of it shifts. But if you think about it at a population level, if the entire human population has shifted its observational patterns over a couple of generations, the way our brains develop start to shift, right? Our knowledge systems start to shift. And part of what I've been after is understanding that. But I've gotten to this place where it's not that, it's not that. I appreciate the word, but it's actually so simple in some ways. It's just understanding the consequence of some simple human shifts over time and what it has done. And that, I think, is an awareness, David, of the simple everyday, but then pulling it out to the scale of the human population over generations. What then happens? And people call it nature connectedness, but there's lots of measures about this. But human contact with the outdoors has been dramatically reduced. And it's why the health fields now, there's like all this work now about doctors starting to prescribe cancer patients going for walks
Yeah.
outside. That's the way to articulate what's happening, but there's actually something happening on the molecular level for people because they're not outside as much. So I appreciate that. And sometimes I think to myself, could it really be that we just need to actually see some of these core things again and imagine systems that don't forget why they were important in the first place? And it's interesting. I just did this workshop where I've been working on, it's the 250th anniversary of the United States, and everyone's thinking about civics. And I was trying to explain to people that Native people had governance systems and treaties way before the founding of the United States. And there's this one that is one of my favorites. It's called the Dish and One Spoon Wampum. And if you've never read about this, it's worth doing it. But it's a treaty between the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe people, hundreds of years before contact. And what it was is a recognition, the dish is the earth. It was the recognition that that dish is what holds and makes life possible. And the one spoon represents people. And it's dull on purpose so that we would be soft and gentle with each other. But it was an agreement that we had shared territory and that we needed to agree to not hoard, that we needed to leave things for others, and that we needed to keep the dish clean. No one likes to eat out of a dirty dish. But it's one of the oldest, it's one of the earliest that I know of outside of my own teachings of agreements across nations that had different teachings. But it's this fundamental understanding that that should be our base governance structure. We didn't need to tell them how to live. We just needed to agree to live well together. And I do think that we've forgotten that there are two tasks on earth, I would argue, to learn to live well with each other and the earth. And we're in a heck of a time in human development to have to re-remember that, also called climate change, but also figuring out how are human beings that now densely populate the earth going to live together sustainably.
Exactly. And no, and I think that while we are at this, in many ways, horrific moment, it really is also the opportunity moment.
Yep.
It's also the necessary opportunity moment. This is where earlier on in this part of the conversation, you matched imagination with efficiency. And it means we have to have the vision so that we can save the world and at the same time save ourselves so that we can live gently together. In the first part of our conversation, Megan Bang gave us a wider frame for thriving, one rooted in relationship, place, community, ancestors, and future generations. In the second part, she brings that frame into pedagogy, how culture shapes cognition, how story and place can support rigorous learning, and how educators can honor Indigenous knowledge without extracting it from the people, histories, and responsibilities to which it belongs.